pirouette, turning circles on the spot. More cheering, more adulation. Marlena spreads her arms in the air, turning to give each section of the audience a chance to adore her. Then she turns to Midnight and perches delicately on his lowered back. He rises, arches his neck, and carries Marlena from the big top. The rest of the horses follow, once again grouped by color, crowding each other to stay close to their mistress. My heart pounds so hard that despite the roaring of the crowd, I am aware of the blood whooshing through my ears. I am filled to overflowing, bursting with love. That night, after Whiskey is rendered Camel dead to the world and Walter is snoring on the bedroll, I leave the little room and stand looking over the backs of the ring stock. I care for these horses daily. I muck out their stalls, fill their water and feed buckets, and groom them for the show. I check their teeth and comb their manes and feel their legs for heat. I give them treats and pat their necks. They had become as familiar a part of my scenery as Queenie. But after seeing Marlena's act, I'll never view them the same way again. These horses are an extension of Marlena, a part of her that is here, right now, with me. I reach over the stall divider and place my hand on a sleek black rump. Midnight, who had been asleep, rumbles in surprise and turns his head. When he sees that it's just me, he turns away. His ears droop, his eyes close, and he shifts his weight so he's resting on one hind leg. I go back to the goat room and check that Camel is still breathing. Then I lie down on the horse blanket and drift into a dream about Marlena that will probably cost me my soul. In front of the steam tables the next morning. "Check that out," says Walter, lifting his arm to poke me in the ribs. "What?" He points. August and Marlena are sitting at our table. It's the first time they've shown up for a meal since her accident. Walter eyeballs me. "You gonna be okay?" "Yes, of course," I say irritably. "Okay, just checking," he says. We pass the ever-vigilant Ezra and head for our separate tables. "Good morning, Jacob," August says as I set my plate on the table and take a seat. "August, Marlena," I say, nodding at each. Marlena looks up quickly and then back at her plate. "And how are you this fine day?" says August. He digs into a pile of scrambled eggs. "Fine. And you?"
"Wonderful," he says.
"And how are you, Marlena?" I ask.
"Very much better, thank you," she says. "I saw your act last night," I say.
"Did you?"
"Yes," I say, shaking my napkin and spreading it across my lap. I don't quite know what to say. It was amazing. I've never seen anything like that."
"Oh,"
says August, cocking one eyebrow.
"Never?"
"No, never."
"Really?"
He stares at me without blinking.
"I thought it was Marlena's act that inspired you to join the show in the first place, Jacob. Was I wrong?"
My heart flips in my chest. I pick up my cutlery. Fork in my left hand, knife in my right, European style, like my mother.
"I lied," I say. I stab the end of a sausage and begin sawing it, waiting for a response. "I beg your pardon," he says. "I lied. I lied!"
I slam my cutlery down, a nub of sausage impaled on the fork. "Okay? Of course I'd never heard of the Benzini brothers before I jumped your train. Who the hell has heard of the Benzini brothers? The only circus I'd seen in my entire life was the Ringling Brothers, and they were great. Great! Do you hear me?" There's an eerie silence. I look around, horrified. Everyone in the tent is staring at me. Walter's jaw is open. Queenie's ears are pressed against her head. In the distance, a camel bellows. Finally, I turn my eyes to August. He, too, is staring. One edge of his mustache quivers. I tuck my napkin under the edge of my plate, wondering if he's going to come across the table at me. August's eyes widen farther. I tense my knuckles under the table. Then August explodes. He laughs so hard he turns red, clutching his midriff and fighting for breath. He laughs and howls until tears run down his face and his lips tremble from exertion.
Oh, Jacob, he says, wiping his cheeks. Oh, Jacob, I think I may have misjudged you. Yes, indeed. I think I may have misjudged you.
He cackles and sniffs, swabbing his face with his napkin. Oh, dear, he sighs. Oh, dear. He clears his throat and picks up his utensils. He scoops some eggs onto his fork and then sets it down again. Once more, overcome with mirth. The other diners return to their food, but reluctantly, like the crowd that watched as I expelled the man from the lot that first day, and I can't help but notice that when they return to their meals, it's with a look of apprehension. Lucinda's death leaves us with a serious deficiency in the freak lineup, and it must be filled. All the big shows have fat ladies, and therefore so must we. Uncle Al and August scour Billboard, and at each stop make telephone calls and send telegrams in an effort to recruit a new one. But all known fat ladies appear either to be happy in their current situation or else leery of Uncle Al's reputation. After 2 weeks and 10 jumps, Uncle Al is so desperate he approaches a woman of generous proportions in the audience. Unfortunately, she turns out to be Mrs. Police Superintendent, and Uncle Al ends up with a shiny purple eye instead of a fat lady, along with summary instructions to leave town. We have 2 hours. The performers immediately sequester themselves in their train cars. The roustabouts, once roused, run around like headless chickens. Uncle Al is breathless and purple, waving his cane and whacking people if they're not moving fast enough for his liking. Tents drop so quickly that men get trapped inside, and then men who are dropping other tents must come and retrieve them before they suffocate in a vast expanse of canvas, or, worse, in Uncle Al's estimation, use their pocket knives to cut a breathing hole. After all the stock is loaded, I retire to the ring stock car. I don't like the look of the townsmen hovering around the edge of the lot. Many are armed, and a bad feeling ferments in the pit of my stomach. I haven't seen Walter yet, and I pace back and forth in front of the open door, scanning the lot. The black men have long since hidden themselves aboard the flying squadron, and I'm not at all convinced that the mob won't content themselves with a red-headed dwarf instead. 1 hour and 55 minutes after we get our marching orders, his face appears in the doorway. "Where the hell have you been?" I shout.
"Is that him?"
croaks Camel from behind the trunks. "Yeah, that's him. Get on up here," I say, waving Walter inside. "The crowd's looking nasty." He doesn't move. He's flushed and out of breath.
"Where's Queenie? You seen Queenie?"
"No, why?" He disappears.
"Walter!" I jump up and follow him to the door. "Walter, where the hell are you going? They've already blown the 5-minute whistle."
He's running alongside the train, ducking to look between its wheels.
"Come on, Queenie. Here, girl."
He straightens up, pausing in front of each stock car, yelling through the slats and then waiting for a response.
"Queenie? Here, girl?"
Each time he calls, his voice reaches a new level of desperation. A whistle blows, a long, sustained warning followed by the hissing and sputtering of the engine. Walter's voice cracks, hoarse with yelling.
"Queenie! Where the hell are you? Queenie! Come!"
Up ahead, the last stragglers are leaping onto flat cars.
"Walter, come on!" I shout. "Don't mess around! You've got to get on now!"
He ignores me. He's up at the flat cars now, peering between wagon wheels.
"Queenie, come!"
he shouts. He stops and suddenly stands straight up. He looks lost.
"Queenie?"
he says to no one in particular. "Ah, hell," I say.
"Is he coming back or what?"
asks Camel. "Doesn't look like it," I say.
"Go get him!"
he barks. The train lurches forward, the cars jerking as the engine pulls the slack from their couplings. I jump to the gravel and run ahead to the flat cars. Walter stands facing the engine. I touch his shoulder. "Walter, it's time to go." He turns to me, his eyes pleading.
"Where is she? Have you seen her?"
"No. Come on, Walter," I say. "We've got to get on the train now."
"I can't,"
he says. His face is blank.
"I can't leave her. I just can't."
The train is chugging forward now, gathering steam. I glance behind me. The townsmen, armed with rifles, baseball bats, and sticks, are surging forward.
I look back at the train long enough to get a sense of speed and count, praying to God that I'm right. 1, 2, 3, 4. I scoop Walter up like a sack of flour and toss him inside. There's a crash and a yelp as he hits the floor. I sprint beside the train and grasp the iron bar beside the door. I let the train pull me along for 3 long strides and then use its velocity to vault up and inside. My face skids across the bucking floorboards. When I realize I'm safe, I look for Walter, prepared for a fight. He's huddled in the corner, crying. Walter is inconsolable. He remains in the corner as I pull the trunks out and retrieve Camel. I manage the old man's shave, a task that usually involves all 3 of us, and then drag him out to the area in front of the horses.
Come on, Walter, says Camel.
I'm holding him by his armpits, dangling his naked posterior over what Walter calls the honey bucket.
You did what you could.
He looks over his shoulder at me.
Hey, lower me a bit, would you? I'm swinging in the breeze here.
I shift my feet so they're further apart, trying to lower Camel while keeping my back straight. Usually Walter takes care of this part because he's the right height. Walter, I could use a hand here, I say as a spasm shoots across my back. Shut up, he says. Camel looks back again, this time with a raised eyebrow. It's okay, I say.
No, it's not okay, Walter yells from the corner. Nothing's okay. Queenie was all I had, you understand that?
His voice drops to a whimper.
She was all I had.
Camel waves his hand at me to indicate he's finished. I shuffle over a couple of feet and lay him on his side.
Now that can't be true, says Camel as I clean him up. A young fella like you's gotta have somebody somewhere.
You don't know nothing.
You ain't got a mother somewhere,
says Camel, persisting.
None I got a use for.
Now don't you talk like that,
says Camel.
Why the hell not? She sold me to this outfit when I was 14.
He glares at us.
And don't you go looking at me like you feel sorry for me, he snaps. She was an old crow anyway. Who the hell needs her?
What do you mean sold you?
Says Camel.
Well, not exactly cut out for farm work, am I? Just leave me the hell alone, will you?
He shuffles around so his back is to us. I fasten Camel's pants, grab him by the armpits and haul him back into the room. His legs drag behind him, his heels scraping the floor.
Man, oh man,
he says as I arrange him on the cot.
Ain't that something?
You ready for some food? I say, trying to change the subject.
No, not yet, but a drop of whiskey would go down well.
He shakes his head sadly.
I ain't never heard of a woman so cold-hearted.
I can still hear you, you know, barks Walter. And besides, you ain't got no talking room, old man. When was the last time you saw your son?
Camel goes pale.
Eh? Can't answer that, can you?
Continues Walter from outside the room.
Ain't such a big difference in what you did and what my mother did, is there?
Yes, there is,
shouts Camel.
There's a world of difference. And how the hell do you know what I did anyway?
You mentioned your son one night when you were tight, I say quietly. Camel stares at me for a moment, then his face contorts. He raises a limp hand to his forehead and turns away from me.
Oh, shit,
he says.
Oh, shit. I never knew you knew,
he says.
You should have told me.
I thought you remembered, I say. Anyway, he didn't say much. He just said you wandered off.
He just said?
Camel's head shoots around.
He just said? What the hell does that mean? You been in touch with him?
I sink to the floor and rest my head on my knees. It's shaping up to be a long night.
What do you mean? He just said, shrieks Camel. I asked you a question.
I sigh. Yes, we got in touch with him.
When?
A while ago. He stares at me stunned.
But why?
He's meeting us in Providence. He's taking you home.
Oh, no,
says Camel, shaking his head vehemently.
Oh, no, he's not.
Camel?
What the hell did you go and do that for? You ain't got no right.
We had no choice,
I shout. I stop, close my eyes, and collect myself. We had no choice, I repeat. We had to do something.
I can't go back, You don't know what happened. They don't want me no more.
His lip quivers, and his mouth shuts. He turns his face away. A moment later, his shoulders start heaving. Ah, hell, I say. I raise my voice, shouting through the open door.
Hey, thanks, Walter. You've been a big help tonight. Sure appreciate it. Fuck off, he answers.
I shut off the kerosene lamp and crawl over to my horse blanket. I lie down on its scratchy surface and then sit up again.
Walter, I shout. Hey, Walter, if you're not coming back in, I'm using the bedroll.
There's no answer.
Did you hear me? I said I'm using the bedroll.
I wait for a minute or two and then crawl across the floor. Walter and Camel spend the night making the noises men make when they're trying not to cry. And I spend the night punching my pillow up around my ears trying not to hear them. I awake to Marlena's voice.
Knock, knock, may I come in?
My eyes snap open. The train has stopped and somehow I slept through it. I'm also startled because I was dreaming about Marlena, and for a moment I wonder if I'm still asleep.
Hello, anyone in there?
I jerk up onto my elbows and look at Camel. He's helpless on the cot, his eyes wide with fear. The interior door has stayed open all night. I leap up.
Hang on a second.
I rush out to meet her, pulling the door shut behind me. She's already climbing into the car.
Oh, hello,
she says, looking at Walter. He's still huddled in the corner.
I was actually looking for you. Isn't this your dog?
Walter's head snaps around.
Queenie!
Marlena leans over to release her, but before she can, Queenie squirms free, hitting the floor with a thunk. She scrabbles across the floor and leaps onto Walter, licking his face and wagging so hard she topples backward.
Oh, Queenie, where were you, you bad, bad girl? You had me so worried, you bad, bad girl.
Walter offers his face and head for licking, and Queenie wiggles and squirms in delight.
Where was she?
I ask, turning to Marlena.
She was running alongside the train when we pulled out yesterday,
she says, keeping her eyes trained on Walter and Queenie.
I saw her from the window and sent Augie out. He got down on his belly on the platform and scooped her up.
August did, I say. Really?
Yes, and then she bit him for his trouble.
Walter wraps both arms around his dog and buries his face in her coat. Marlena watches for a moment longer and then turns toward the door.
Well, I guess I'll be on my way,
she says.
Marlena,
I say, reaching for her arm. She stops. Thank you, I say, dropping my hand. You have no idea what this means to him. To us, really. She throws me the quickest of glances, with just the merest hint of a smile, and then looks over the backs of her horses.
Yes. Yes, I think I do.
My eyes are moist as she climbs down from the car.
Well, what do you know? Says Camel. Maybe he's human after all.
Who? August, says Walter. He leans, grabs the handle of a trunk, and drags it across the floor. We're arranging the room into its daytime configuration, although Walter does everything at half speed because he insists on holding Queenie under one arm.
Never.
You can let her go, you know, I say. The door's closed.
He saved your dog,
Camel points out.
He wouldn't have if he'd known she was mine.
Queenie knows that. That's why she bit him.
Yes, you knew, didn't you, baby?
He says, pulling her snout up to his face and reverting to baby talk.
Yes, Queenie is a clever girl.
What makes you think he didn't know? I say. Marlena knew.
Because I just know. There's not a human bone in that kike's body.
Watch your damn mouth, I shout. Walter stops to look at me.
What? Wow. Hey, you're not Jewish, are you? Look, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. It was just a cheap shot, he says.
Yes, it was a cheap shot, I say, still shouting. They're all cheap shots, and I'm getting mighty damn sick of them. If you're a performer, you take shots at the working men. If you're a working man, you take shots at Poles. If you're a Pole, you take shots at the Jews. And if you're a dwarf, well, you tell me, Walter. Is it just Jews and working men you hate, or do you also hate Poles?
Walter reddens and looks down. I don't hate them. I don't hate anybody.
After a moment, he adds,
well, okay, I really do hate August, but I hate him because he's a crazy son of a bitch.
Can't argue with that,
croaks Camel. I look from Camel to Walter and then back again.
No, I say with a sigh.
No, I suppose you can't. In Hamilton, the temperature creeps up into the 90s. The sun beats relentlessly on the lot, and the lemonade goes missing. The man from the juice joint, who left the great mixing vat for no more than a few minutes, storms off to Uncle Al, convinced that roustabouts are responsible. Uncle Al has them rounded up. They emerge from behind the stable tent and menagerie, sleepy, with straw in their hair. I observe from some distance, but it's hard not to think they have an air of innocence about them. Apparently Uncle Al doesn't agree. He storms back and forth, bellowing like Genghis Khan at a troop inspection. He screams in their faces, details the cost, both in supplies and lost sales, of the stolen lemonade, and tells them that every one of them will have his pay docked the next time it happens. He whacks a few upside the head and dismisses them. They creep back to their resting spots, rubbing their heads and eyeing each other with suspicion. With only 10 minutes before the gate opens, the men at the juice joint mix up another batch using water from the animal troughs. They filter out the stray oats, hay, and whiskers through a pair of hose donated by a clown. And by the time they toss in the floaters, wax lemon slices designed to give the impression that the concoction actually met fruit somewhere along the line, a swell of rubes is already approaching the midway. I don't know if the hose were clean, but I do notice that everyone on the show abstains from drinking lemonade that day. The lemonade goes missing again in Dayton. Once again, a new batch is mixed up with trough water and set out moments before the rubes descend. This time, when Uncle Al rounds up all the usual suspects, rather than docking their pay, a meaningless threat anyway, since not one of them has been paid in more than 8 weeks, he forces them to fish out the chamois grouch bags that hang around their necks and hand over 2 quarters each. The holders of the grouch bags become grouchy indeed. The lemonade thief has hit the roustabouts where it hurts, and they're prepared to take action. When we get to Columbus, a few of them hide near the mixing vat and wait. Shortly before showtime, August summons me to Marlena's dressing tent to look at an advertisement for a white Liberty horse. Marlena needs another because 12 horses are more spectacular than 10, and spectacular is what it's all about. Besides, Marlena thinks Boaz is getting depressed at being left by himself in the menagerie while the others perform. This is what August says, but I think I'm being restored to favor after my blow-up in the cookhouse. That, or August has decided to keep his friends close, and his enemies even closer. I'm sitting in a folding chair with billboard on my lap and a bottle of sarsaparilla in my hand. Marlena is at a mirror adjusting her costume, and I'm trying not to stare. The one time our eyes meet in the mirror, I catch my breath. She reddens, and we both look elsewhere. August is oblivious, buttoning his waistcoat and chatting amiably when Uncle Al bursts through the flap. Marlena turns, outraged.
Hey, ever heard of asking before you barge into a lady's dressing tent?
Uncle Al pays no attention to her at all. He marches straight to August and jabs his finger in his chest. It's your goddamn bull, he screams. August looks down at the finger sticking into his chest, pauses a few beats, and then takes it daintily between thumb and forefinger. He moves Uncle Al's hand aside, and then flicks a handkerchief from his pocket to wipe the spit from his face.
I beg your pardon, he asks at the end of this operation.
It's your goddamn thieving bull, screams Uncle Al, once again showering August with spit. She pulls out a steak, takes it with her, drinks the goddamn lemonade, then goes back and sticks a steak in the ground. Marlena claps a hand over her mouth, but not in time. Uncle Al spins, furious. You think it's funny? You think it's funny? The blood drains from her face. I rise from my chair and step forward. Well, you have to admit, there's a certain... Uncle Al turns, plants both hands squarely on my chest, and shoves me so hard I fall backward onto a trunk. He twists around to August. That fucking bull cost me a fortune. She's the reason I couldn't pay the men and had to take care of business. And caught heat from the goddamn railroad authority. And for what? The goddamn thing won't perform, and she steals the fucking lemonade. Al, August says sharply, watch your mouth.
I'll have you remember you're in the presence of a lady. Uncle Al's head swivels. He regards Marlena without remorse and turns back to August.
Woody's going to tally up the losses, he says. I'm taking it from your pay.
You've already taken it from the roustabouts, Marlena says quietly. Are you planning to return their money?
Uncle Al gazes upon her, and I like his expression so little I step forward until I'm between them. He turns his gaze to me, his jaw grinding in anger. Then he turns and marches out.
What a jerk, says Marlena, going back to her dressing table. I could have been getting dressed.
August stands utterly still. Then he reaches for his top hat and bull hook. Marlena sees this in the mirror.
Where are you going? She says quickly. August, what are you doing?
He heads for the doorway. She grabs his arm.
Augie, where are you going?
I'm not the only one who's going to pay for the lemonade,
he says, shaking her off.
August, no.
She grabs his elbow again. This time she throws her weight into it, trying to prevent him from leaving.
August, wait. For God's sake, she didn't know. We'll secure her better next time.
August wrenches free, and Marlena crashes to the ground. He looks at her in utter disgust. Then he plants his hat on his head and turns away.
August!
She shrieks.
Stop!
He pushes the flap open and is gone. Marlena sits stunned exactly where she fell. I look from her to the flap and then back again. I'm going after him, I say, heading for the doorway.
No, wait!
I freeze.
There's no use,
she says, her voice hollow and small.
You can't stop him.
I could sure as hell try. I did nothing last time, and I'll never forgive myself.
You don't understand. You'll only make it worse. Jacob, please, you don't understand.
I spin to face her. No, I don't. I don't understand anything anymore. Not a damn thing. Would you care to enlighten me? Her eyes open wide. Her mouth forms an O. Then she buries her face in her hands and bursts into tears. I stare, horrified. Then I fall to my knees and gather her in my arms.
Oh, Marlena, Marlena, Jacob,
she whispers into my shirt. She clings to me as tightly as if I were keeping her from being sucked into a vortex.
Chapter 16.
My name isn't Rosie, it's Rosemary. You know that, Mr. Jankowski. I am startled into awareness, blinking up into the unmistakable glare of fluorescent lighting. Huh? What? My voice is thin, reedy. A black woman leans over me, tucking something around my legs. Her hair is fragrant and smooth. You called me Rosie just a minute ago. My name is Rosemary, she says, straightening up. There. Now isn't that better? I stare at her. Oh, God. That's right. I am old, and I'm in bed. Wait a minute. I called her Rosie? I was talking? Out loud? She laughs. Oh, dear, yes. Oh, yes, Mr. Jankowski. You've been talking a blue streak since we left the lunchroom. Just talking my ear off. My face flushes. I stare at the clawed hands in my lap. God only knows what I've been saying. I only know what I've been thinking, and even that's in retrospect, until I suddenly found myself here. Now, I thought I was there. Why, what's the matter? Rosemary says. Did I say anything? Embarrassing? Heavens no, I don't understand why you haven't told the others, what with everyone going to the circus and all. I'll bet you've never even mentioned it, though, have you? Rosemary watches me expectantly. Then her brow furrows. She pulls a chair over and sits next to me. You don't remember talking to me, do you? She says gently. I shake my head. She takes both my hands in hers. They are warm and firmly fleshed. You said nothing to be embarrassed of, Mr. Jankowski. You're a fine gentleman. and I'm honored to know you. My eyes fill and I drop my head so she won't see. Mr. Jankowski, I don't want to talk about it. About the circus? No, about... Oh, hell, don't you understand? I didn't even realize I was talking. It's the beginning of the end. It's all downhill from here, and I didn't have very far to go. But I was really hoping to hang on to my brains. I really was. You still have your brains, Mr. Jankowski. You're sharp as a tack. We sit in silence for a minute. I'm scared, Rosemary. Do you want me to talk to Dr. Rashid? She asks. I nod. A tear slips from my eye and into my lap. I hold my eyes wide, hoping to contain the rest. It's another hour before you have to be ready to go. Would you like to rest a spell? I nod again. She gives my hand a final pat, lowers the head of my bed, and leaves. I lie back, listening to the buzzing lights and staring at the square tiles of the drop ceiling, an expanse of pressed popcorn, of tasteless rice cakes. If I'm completely honest with myself, there have been hints I was slipping. Last week, when my people came, I didn't know them. I faked it, though, when they made their way toward me and I realized it was me they'd come to see. I smiled, made all the usual placating noises, the oh yeses and goodness graciouses that make up my end of most conversations these days. I thought it was going just fine until a peculiar look crossed the mother's face, a horrified look with her forehead scrumpled and her jaw slightly open. I raced back over the last few minutes of the conversation and realized I'd said the wrong thing, the polar opposite of what I should have said. And then I was mortified. Because I don't dislike Isabel, I just don't know her. So I was having trouble paying attention to the details of her disastrous dance recital. But then this Isabel turned and laughed, and in that instant I saw my wife. This made me weepy, and these people whom I didn't recognize exchanged furtive glances and shortly thereafter announced that it was time to leave because Grandpa needed his rest. They patted my hand, and they tucked my blanket in around my knees, and they left. They went out into the world, and they left me here. And to this day, I have no idea who they were. I know my children, don't get me wrong, but these are not my children. These are the children of my children, and their children too, and maybe even theirs. Did I coo into their baby faces? Did I dandle them on my knee? I had 3 sons and 2 daughters, a house full indeed, and none of them exactly held back. You multiply 5 by 4 and then by 5 again, and it's no wonder I forget how some of them fit in. It doesn't help that they take turns coming to see me, because even if I manage to commit one group to memory, they may not come around again for another 8 or 9 months, by which time I've forgotten whatever it was I may have known. But what happened today was entirely different. And much, much scarier. What in God's name did I say? I close my eyes and reach for the far corners of my mind. They're no longer clearly defined. My brain is like a universe whose gases get thinner and thinner at the edges. But it doesn't dissolve into nothingness. I can sense something out there, just beyond my grasp, hovering, waiting. And God help me if I'm not skidding toward it again, mouth open wide.
Chapter 17.
While August is off doing God knows what to Rosie, Marlena and I crouch on the grass in her dressing tent, clinging to each other like spider monkeys. I say almost nothing, just hold her head to my chest as her history spills out in a rushed whisper. She tells me about meeting August. She was 17, and it had just dawned on her that the recent spate of bachelors joining her family for dinner were actually being presented as potential husbands. When one middle-aged banker with a receding chin, thinning hair, and reedy fingers showed up for dinner one time too many, she heard the doors of her future slamming all around her. But even as the banker sniveled something that made Marlena blanch and stare in horror at her bowl of clam chowder, posters were being slapped up on every surface in town. The wheels of fate were in motion. The Benzini Brothers' most spectacular show on earth was chugging toward them at that very moment, bringing with it a very real fantasy, and, for Marlena, an escape that would prove as romantic as it was terrifying. 2 days later, on a brilliantly sunny day, the Larsh family went to the circus. Marlena was standing in the menagerie tent in front of a string of stunning black and white Arabians when August first approached her. Her parents had wandered off to look at the cats, oblivious to the force that was about to enter their lives. And August was a force. Charming, gregarious, and handsome as the devil. Dressed immaculately in blinding white jodhpurs, top hat, and tails, he radiated both authority and irresistible charisma. Within minutes, he had secured the promise of a surreptitious meeting and disappeared before the Larsh seniors rejoined their daughter. When she met him later, at an art gallery, he began wooing her in earnest. He was 12 years her senior, and glamorous in the way only an equestrian director can be. Before the end of the date, he had proposed. He was charming and relentless. He refused to budge until she married him. He regaled her with stories of Uncle Al's desperation, and Uncle Al himself made pleas on August's behalf. They had already missed two jumps. A circus could not survive if it blew its route. This was an important decision, yes, but surely she understood how this was affecting them, that the lives of countless others depended on her making the right choice. The 17-year-old Marlena gazed upon her future in Boston for 3 more evenings, and on the 4th, packed a suitcase. At this point in her story, she dissolves into tears. I'm still holding her, still rocking back and forth. Eventually, she pulls away, wiping her eyes with her hands. "You should go," she says. "I don't want to." She whimpers, reaching across the divide to stroke my cheek with the back of her hand. "I want to see you again," I say. "You see me every day. You know what I mean." There's a long pause. She drops her gaze to the ground. Her mouth moves a few times before she finally speaks. "I can't. Marlena, for God's sake, I just can't. I'm married. I made my bed, and now I have to lie in it." I kneel in front of her, searching her face for a signal to stay. After an agonizing wait, I realize I'm not going to find one. I kiss her on the forehead and leave. Before I've gone 40 yards, I've heard more than I ever wanted to about how Rosie paid for the lemonade. Apparently, August stormed into the menagerie and banished everyone. The puzzled menagerie men and a handful of others stood outside, their ears pressed to the seams of the great canvas tent as a torrent of angry screaming began. This sent the rest of the animals into a panic. The chimps screeched, the cats roared, the zebras yelped. Despite this, the distraught listeners could still make out the hollow thud of bullhook hitting flesh again and again and again. At first, Rosie bellowed and whimpered. When she progressed to squealing and shrieking, many of the men turned away, unable to take any more. One of them ran for Earl, who entered the menagerie and hauled August out by his armpits. He kicked and struggled like a madman, even as Earl dragged him across the lot and up the stairs into the privilege car. The remaining men found Rosie lying on her side. Quivering, her foot still chained to a stake.
"I hate that man," says Walter as I climb into the stock car.
He's sitting on the cot, stroking Queenie's ears.
"I really, really hate that man."
"Someone want to tell me what's going on?"
Camel calls from behind the row of trunks.
"'Cause I know something is. Jacob, help me out here. Walter ain't talking."
I say nothing.
There was no call to be that brutal. No call at all,
Walter continues.
"He damn near started a stampede, too. Could have killed the lot of us. Were you there? Did you hear any of it?"
Our eyes meet. "No," I say.
"Well, I wouldn't mind knowing what in blazes you're talking about," says Camel. "But it seems I don't count for squat here. Hey, ain't it dinner time?"
"I'm not hungry," I say.
"Me neither," says Walter.
"Well, I am," says Camel, disgruntled. "But I bet neither of you thought of that. And I bet neither one of you picked up so much as a piece of bread for an old man."
Walter and I look at each other.
"Well, I was there," he says, his eyes full of accusation. "You want to know what I heard?" he says.
"No," I say, staring at Queenie. She meets my gaze and whacks the blanket a few times with her stump.
"You sure?"
"Yes, I'm sure.
Thought you might be interested, you being the vet and all."
"I am interested," I say loudly, "but I'm also afraid of what it might make me do."
Walter looks at me for a long time.
"So who's going to get that old get some grub? You or me?"
"Hey, mind your manners," cries the old git.
"I'll go," I say. I turn and leave the stock car.
Halfway to the cookhouse, I realize I'm grinding my teeth.
When I come back with Camel's food, Walter is gone. A few minutes later, he returns, carrying a large bottle of whiskey in each hand.
"Well, God bless your soul,"
cackles Camel, who is now propped up in the corner. He points at Walter with a limp hand.
"Where in tarnation did you come up with that?"
"A friend on the pie car owed me a favor. I figured we could all use a little forgetting tonight."
"Well, go on then," says Camel. "Stop yapping and hand it over."
Walter and I turn in unison to glare. The lines on Camel's grizzled face furrow deeper.
"Well, geez, you two sure are a couple of sour pusses, ain't you? What's the matter? Someone spitting your soup?"
"Air.
Pay him no mind," says Walter, shoving a bottle of whiskey against my chest.
"What do you mean, pay him no mind? In my day, a boy was taught to respect his elders."
Instead of answering, Walter carries the other bottle over and crouches down beside him. When Camel reaches for it, Walter bats his hand away.
"Hell no, old man. You spill that and we'll all three be sour pusses."
He raises the bottle up to Camel's lips and holds it as he swallows a half dozen times. He looks like a baby taking a bottle. Walter turns on his heels and leans against the wall. Then he takes a long swig himself.
"What's the matter? Don't like the whiskey?"
he says, wiping his mouth and gesturing at the unopened bottle in my hand.
"I like it just fine. Listen, I don't have any money, so I don't know when or if I can ever make it up to you. But can I have this?"
"I already gave it to you."
"No, I mean, can I take it for someone else?"
Walter looks at me for a moment, his eyes crinkled at the edges.
"It's a woman, isn't it?"
"Nope."
"You're lying."
"No, I'm not."
"I'll bet you $5 it's a woman,"
he says, taking another drink. His Adam's apple bobs up and down, and the brown liquid lowers by almost an inch. It's astounding how quickly he and Camel manage to get hard liquor down their gullets. "She is female," I say.
"Ha!" snorts Walter. "You better not let her hear you say that. Although whoever or whatever she is, she's more suitable than where your mind's been lately."
"I've got some making up to do," I say. "I let her down today." Walter looks up in sudden understanding.
"How about a little more of that?"
Camel says irritably.
"Maybe he don't want none, but I do. Not that I blame the boy for wanting a little action. You're only young once. You gotta get it while you can," I says. "Yes, sir, get it while you can. Even if it costs you a bottle of sauce."
Walter smiles.
He holds the bottle up to Camel's lips again and lets him have several long swallows. Then he caps it, leans across, still on his haunches, and hands it to me.
Take her this one, too. You tell her I'm also sorry. Real sorry, in fact.
Hey, shouts Camel. There ain't no woman in the world worth two bottles of whiskey. Come on, now. I rise to my feet and slip a bottle in each pocket of my jacket.
Oh, come on, now, Camel pleads. Oh, that just ain't no fair.
His wheedling and complaining follow me until I'm out of earshot. It's dusk, and several parties have already started at the performer's end of the train, including, I can't help but notice, one in Marlena and August's car. I wouldn't have gone, but it's significant that I wasn't invited. I guess August and I are on the outs again, or rather, since I already hate him more than I've ever hated anyone or anything in my life, I guess I'm on the outs with him. Rosie is at the far end of the menagerie, and as my eyes adjust to the twilight, I see someone standing beside her. It's Greg, the man from the cabbage patch.
Hey,
I say as I approach. He turns his head. He's holding a tube of zinc ointment in one hand and is dabbing Rosie's punctured skin. There are a couple of dozen white spots on this side alone.
Jesus, I say, surveying her. Droplets of blood and histamine ooze up under the zinc.
Her amber eyes seek mine. She blinks those outrageously long lashes and sighs, a great whooshing exhalation that rattles all through her trunk. I'm flooded with guilt.
What do you want? Grunts Greg, continuing with his task.
I just wanted to see how she was.
Well, you can see that, can't you?
Now if you'll excuse me, he says, dismissing me.
He turns back to her.
Noga, he says. No, dai noga.
After a moment, the elephant lifts her foot and holds it in front of her. Greg kneels down and rubs some ointment in her armpit, right in front of her strange gray breast, which hangs from her chest like a woman's.
Yestish the road. Jevchenko,
he says, standing up and screwing the cap back on the ointment.
Polish nogo.
Rosie sets her foot back on the ground.
Masz, moja piękna,
he says, digging in his pocket. Her trunk swings around, investigating. He pulls out a mint, brushes off the lint, and hands it to her. She plucks it nimbly from his fingers and pops it in her mouth. I stare in shock. I think my mouth may even be open. In the space of 2 seconds, my mind is zigzagged from her unwillingness to perform, to her history with the elephant tramp, to her lemonade thievery, and back to the cabbage patch.
Jesus Christ, I say.
What?
Says Greg, fondling her trunk.
She understands you.
Yes. So what?
What do you mean, so what? My God, do you have any idea what this means?
Now wait just a cotton-picking minute. Greg says as I come up to Rosie. He forces a shoulder between us, his face hard.
Humor me, I say. Please. About the last thing in the world I'd do is hurt this bull.
He continues to stare at me. I'm still not entirely sure he won't clobber me from behind, but I turn to Rosie anyway. She blinks at me.
Rosie, no go, I say.
She blinks again and opens her mouth in a smile.
No go, Rosie.
She fans her ears and sighs.
Prochon, I say.
She sighs again. Then she shifts her weight and lifts her foot. Dear Mother of God.
I hear my voice as though from outside of my body. My heart is pounding, my head spinning.
Rosie,
I say, laying a hand on her shoulder.
Just one more thing.
I look her straight in the eye, pleading with her.
Surely she knows how important this is. Please, God, please, God, please, God.
Dotewu, Rosie, dotewu.
Another deep sigh, another subtle shifting of weight, and then she takes a couple of steps backward. I yelp with delight and turn to an astonished Greg. I leap forward, grab him by the shoulders, and kiss him full on the mouth.
What the hell?
I sprint for the exit. About 15 feet away, I stop and turn around. Greg is still spitting, wiping his mouth in disgust. I dig the bottles out of my pockets. His expression changes to one of interest, the back of his hand still raised to his mouth.
Here, catch, I say, sending a bottle flying at him. He snags it from the air, looks at its label, and then glances up, hopefully, at the other. I toss it to him. Give those to our new star, will you? Greg cocks his head thoughtfully and turns to Rosie, who's already smiling and reaching for the bottles. For the next 10 days, I serve as August's personal Polish coach. In each city, he has a practice ring set up in the back end, and day after day, the four of us, August, Marlena, Rosie, and I, spend the hours between our arrival in town and the start of the matinee working on Rosie's act. Although she already takes part in the daily parade and spec, she has yet to perform in the show. Although the weight is killing Uncle Al, August doesn't want to unveil her act until it's perfect. I spend my days sitting on a chair just outside the ring curb with a knife in one hand and a bucket between my legs, cutting fruit and vegetables into chunks for the primates and shouting Polish phrases as required. August's accent is appalling, but Rosie, perhaps because August is usually repeating something I've just yelled, obeys without fail. He hasn't touched her with the bull hook since we discovered the language barrier. He just walks beside her, waving it under her belly and behind her legs. But never, not once, does it make contact. It's hard to reconcile this August and the other one, and to be honest, I don't even try very hard. I've seen flashes of this August before. This brightness, this conviviality, this generosity of spirit. But I know what he's capable of, and I won't forget it. The others can believe what they like, but I don't believe for a second that this is the real August and the other an aberration. And yet, I can see how they might be fooled. He is delightful. He's charming. He shines like the sun. He lavishes attention on the great storm-colored beast and her tiny rider from the moment we meet in the morning until the moment they disappear for the parade. He is attentive and tender toward Marlena, and kindly and paternal toward Rosie. He seems unaware that there ever was any bad blood between us, despite my reserve. He smiles broadly. He pats me on the back. He notices that my clothes are shabby, and that very afternoon, the Monday man arrives with more. He declares that the show's vet should not have to bathe with buckets of cold water and invites me to shower in the stateroom. And when he finds out that Rosie likes gin and ginger ale better than anything in the world, except perhaps watermelon, he ensures that she gets both every single day. He cozies up to her. He whispers in her ear, and she basks in the attention, trumpeting happily at the sight of him. Doesn't she remember? I scrutinize him, watching for chinks. But the new August persists. Before long, his optimism permeates the entire lot. Even Uncle Al is affected. He stops each day to observe our progress, and within a couple of days, orders up new posters that feature Rosie with Marlena sitting astride her head. He stops whacking people. Shortly thereafter, people stop ducking. He becomes positively jolly. Rumors circulate that there may actually be money on payday, and even the working men begin to crack smiles. It's only when I catch Rosie actually purring under August's loving ministrations that my conviction starts to crumble. And what I'm left looking at in its place is a terrible thing. Maybe it was me. Maybe I wanted to hate him because I'm in love with his wife. And if that's the case, what kind of a man does that make me? In Pittsburgh, I finally go to confession. I break down in the confessional and sob like a baby, telling the priest about my parents, my night of debauchery, and my adulterous thoughts. The somewhat startled priest mutters a few there-theres, and then tells me to pray the rosary and forget about Marlena. I'm too ashamed to admit that I haven't got a rosary, so when I return to the stock car, I ask Walter and Camel if either of them has one. Walter looks at me strangely, and Camel offers me a green elk tooth necklace. I'm well aware of Walter's opinion. He still hates August beyond all expression, and although he doesn't say anything, I know exactly what he thinks of my shifting opinion. We still share the care and feeding of Camel,
but the three of us no longer exchanged stories during the long nights spent on the rails. Instead, Walter reads Shakespeare, and Camel gets drunk and cranky and increasingly demanding. In Medville, August decides that tonight is the night. When he delivers the good news, Uncle Al is rendered speechless. He clasps his hand to his breast and looks starward with tear-filled eyes. Then, as his grovelers duck for cover, he reaches out and claps August on the shoulder. He gives him a manly shake and then, because he's clearly too overwhelmed to actually say anything, gives him another. I'm examining a cracked hoof in the blacksmith tent when August sends for me. August, I say, placing my face near the opening of Marlena's dressing tent. It billows slightly, snapping in the wind. You wanted to see me?
Jacob, he calls out in a booming voice. So glad you could come. Please, come in, my boy.
Marlena is in costume. She sits in front of her vanity with one foot up on its edge, wrapping the long pink ribbon from one of her slippers around her ankle. August sits nearby in top hat and tails. He twirls a silver-tipped cane. Its handle is bent like a bull hook.
Please, take a seat,
he says, rising from his chair and patting its seat. I hesitate for a fraction of a second and then cross the tent. Once I'm seated, August stands in front of us. I glance over at Marlena.
Marlena? Jacob? My dearest dear, and my dearest friend, says August, removing his hat and gazing upon us with moist eyes. This last week has been amazing in so many ways. I think it would not be an exaggeration to call it a journey of the soul. Just 2 weeks ago, this show was on the brink of collapse. The livelihood, and indeed, in this financial climate, I think I can safely say, the lives... Yes, the very lives of everyone on this show were in danger. And do you want to know why?
His bright eyes move from me to Marlena, from Marlena to me. Why? Marlena asks obligingly, lifting her other leg and wrapping the broad satin ribbon round her ankle.
Because we went into the hole acquiring an animal that was supposed to be the salvation of our show. And because we also had to buy a train car to house her. And because we then discovered that this animal apparently knew nothing, yet ate everything. And because keeping her fed meant that we couldn't afford to feed our employees, and we had to let some of them go.
My head snaps up at this oblique reference to red lighting, but August stares beyond me, at a side wall. He is silent, uncomfortably long, almost as though he's forgotten we're here. Then he remembers himself with a start.
But we have been saved, he says, gazing down at me with love in his eyes. And the reason we have been saved is that we have been doubly blessed. Fate was smiling on us that day in June when she led Jacob to our train. She handed us not only a veterinarian with an Ivy League degree, a veterinarian befitting a big show like ours, but also a veterinarian so devoted to his charges that he made a most amazing discovery. A discovery that ended up saving the show. No, really, all I... Not a word, Jacob. I won't let you deny it. I had a feeling about you the very first time I laid eyes on you. Didn't I, dear?
August turns to Marlena and waggles his finger at her. She nods. With her second slipper secured, she removes her foot from the edge of the vanity and crosses her legs. Her toes start bobbing immediately. August gazes at her.
But Jacob didn't work alone, he continues. You, my beautiful and talented darling, have been brilliant. And Rosie, because she... of all of us, is not to be forgotten in this equation. So patient, so willing, so...
He stops and inhales so deeply his nostrils flare. When he continues, his voice cracks.
Because she is a beautiful, magnificent animal with a heart full of forgiveness and the capacity to appreciate misunderstanding.